So it feels like the whole world economy is being restructured.
We're only going to get to net zero if the stuff that we're doing and the products that we're using and the technology we're deploying is superior to what is being used already. Because that's how markets work. That's how mass adoption works.
A lot of these things are reminding people that physical materials and physical supply chains matter. You thought that you were living in this world where everything was dematerializing, where all you needed was a social media app and that's all that mattered. Well, guess what? It turns out that the internet is physical. It's based on cables. Guess what? It turns out that all these products like smartphones and everything else are physical and they're based on getting them from one place to another and converting them from base materials into extraordinary things.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back for another installment of Transmission. In today's episode, Quentin is joined by Ed Conway, author and economics and data editor at Sky News, and Richard Tite, chief investment officer at TechMet. The conversation is a deep dive into supply chains and the world of raw materials. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, please consider hitting subscribe and giving us a rating. Let's jump in.
Hello, Ed. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Hi there.
We are very excited to have you both on. For if you're listening to this or watching this, this is a double header. So this is a special. And we've got a couple of people on to talk about supply chains, minerals, metals, and all that stuff. So firstly, we've got Richard Tite on, who is Chief Investment Officer at TechMet. If you haven't heard of TechMet, what they do is very interesting. They're backed by the US government, and they allocate capital to get strategic control over the production of metals that will define and power the 21st century economy. And Richard really understands the whole macro picture, as well as what's happening in each individual part of supply chains and where the squeezes and the bottlenecks are. So we're really excited to have Richard on. But secondly, we've got Ed Conway on. You probably know Ed already as economics editor on Sky News. He's also a well-esteemed author. You've probably seen his latest book. It was shortlisted for Financial Times Business Book of the Year. And in that book, Ed talks a lot about natural resources, specifically sand, salt, iron, copper, oil, and lithium. And so if you haven't read that, please do check it out. We'll put the link in the show notes. So Ed, Richard, we are very, very excited to have you on. And just to set some rules about this discussion, I know you both cover very different things. And Ed, you're a journalist and probably have to be unbiased, although your book delves into some really big detail. And Richard, I wonder whether you have any rules. How should we do this conversation?
Well, okay. Well, I mean, so I am happy to just, I can blather on about materials as much as you want. I'm a journalist. So as you say, I'm not an expert, and I'm sure that many of your listeners are going to be far more expert than I am on a lot of this stuff. But I think that the fact that I'm here kind of talking about this stuff and the fact that I've written a book about it, I think underlines that this, what your business deals with what Richard does, it's become so mainstream. You know, everyone is now fixated, focused on the energy transition. And kind of all my book attempts to do is to kind of put that into a bigger perspective to say, listen, there's a lot of catastrophism, a lot of fear, but a lot of excitement as well about what we're going through. Actually, humanity has done this throughout its existence. And then one of the exciting things is that what are humans? We take stuff out of the ground, turn it into tools to make our lives better. And that is what we're doing now, you know, with what the companies that Richard's involved with are doing, really exciting things to try and make the energy transition actually happen. And so I it's exciting that this has now become a mainstream thing that I can talk about and that people won't just kind of look at you blankly, because that just means it's becoming real, doesn't it?
And yeah, I absolutely agree with what Ed said. When we started TechMet in 2017, you know, we saw this big challenge ahead of us that if we're going to electrify the world and stop burning petrol and diesel to move around and put a battery in everything, we needed to start immediately on the challenge of scaling all the raw materials that we're going to need so everyone can have a battery. And back then, you know, it wasn't mainstream. No one was talking about it. I think what's really changed, certainly since the pandemic, has been how the challenge of how we scale this technology has certainly risen in the popular consciousness. And the fact that Ed has chosen to write a book on it is just kind of demonstrates how it is passing from the kind of specialists to the generalists in terms of the awareness.
So it feels like the whole world economy is being restructured rather than just sort of financial assets, rather than real things, right? Minerals and commodities. Is that just net zero that's causing this, or is there something bigger that's happening?
I think the revolution that we're going through in mobility is really one that's driven ultimately by technology, and it's the superiority of the technology relative to the incumbent, what we're using already. The fact that we also can cure the dreadful externality of producing carbon in order to go about our economic lives is obviously existentially important. But we're never going to get to net zero with goodwill. We're only going to get to net zero if the stuff that we're doing and the products that we're using and the technology we're deploying is superior to what is being used already. Because that's how markets work. That's how mass adoption works. And that's the key that's driving all of this. I think also the first 20 years of the 21st century were all about software. We're all about the tech majors. The marginal cost of production of software is zero. You just, you know, at a stroke of a button, you can push out millions of copies of it into the world. We now have to re-engage with the world of atoms and molecules, which are difficult and tricky and costly and don't scale in the same way. And I think we have to relearn a lot of the lessons we went through in the first great phase of industrialization. You know, we are now on the cusp of a great new industrial revolution, sort of 3.0.
Mm, I would so totally kind of underline that. When you look at the history of all of the different amazing things that we have discovered, processes that go back to the Industrial Revolution, you see there's a few things. First of all, it's kind of extraordinary. Second of all, by the way, when a lot of this stuff happened, there were well understood challenges that people needed to resolve that had been laid down, whether it was turning salt into soda ash, or, you know, creating something that could preserve your materials, or actually being able to make iron out of using kind of coking coal rather, or a form of coal rather than wood. Everyone kind of knew, or inventing concrete, everyone kind of knew what needed to be done. And there were amazing advances there, but a lot of it was really kind of like carbon intensive. The striking thing about what we're going through right now is you need to reimagine almost all of those processes. And it's kind of amazing the breadth of processes we're talking about. I often think of like silicon chips and semiconductors was to try to understand that supply chain, not just the bit in the foundry, you know, where there's been quite a lot of focus, but all the way back to the quarry where the stuff comes out of the ground. And so you need to take, and it's the same, as you know, it's the same supply chain pretty much up until the end for solar panels as well. And you need to mine stuff. You need to get the silicon out of the ground. You need to turn it into metallurgical silicon, which involves putting it into an electric arc furnace and heating it up to, you know, 1,500 degrees alongside wood chips and coal. So there's, you know, there's chemical and there's physical energetic kind of carbon emissions at that point. And all the way through, we're turning it into polysilicon, turning it into a silicon wafer. All of these different processes are seriously energy intensive. And I think when you see that across the piece, when you realize that for almost everything we make, there are likely to be some carbon emissions, then I think you start to understand, as Richard's saying, the scale of this, the fact that it's an industrial revolution. It's not just about, you know, making wind turbines and batteries, that that's an important part of it. It is also about conceptually thinking about a whole new way of the world working. So that's kind of exciting, but also just desperately terrifying as well, because I don't think people, when they signed up to the various net zero pledges, you know, in the UK, we made it law in 2019. Did anyone in the cabinet room understand the scale of it? No, not a bit of it. And I know that having talked to people who were in the cabinet room when they were signing up to it, they didn't understand what it actually entailed. Well, we're now starting to understand it, and understanding it but via, you know, actually kind of low down through these minerals and what you need to do with them. So first getting them out of the ground, but also what you need to do with them to turn them into amazing things like batteries and solar panels. Then it starts to make sense. Golly, this is like an enormous thing we need to do. The only thing I'd add, because, you know, back to your question, what makes it different this time around is we are doing this, we're doing this at the same time as everyone else. And so there is definitely a rush. I don't know if it's a race, but certainly, and Richard will kind of be able to tell you more about that. But a lot of people are rushing to get these things. A lot of governments are really focused on it. A lot of people are aware on that. And secondly, and you know, we are potentially in the beginning of a new Cold War, and that geopolitics is resurfacing in a massive way right now. And it's not just about the US and China. It's also about what we see in the Middle East at the moment. The Red Sea, you know, people having trouble getting through the Red Sea, shippers saying they can't go through there. A lot of these things are reminding people that physical materials and physical supply chains matter. And, you know, you thought, like Richard said, you thought that you were living in this world where everything was dematerializing. Well, all you needed was a social media app, and that's all that mattered. Well, guess what? It turns out that the internet is physical. It's based on cables. Guess what? It turns out that all these products like smartphones and everything else are physical, and they're based on getting them from one place to another and converting them from base materials into extraordinary things. All of that never went away. It was always important, but now it's going into the stratosphere. And I think, you know, it's a bit of a wake-up call the last few years in various different guises. And golly, we really do need to wake up and try and work out how we're going to get there.
Okay, then we've talked a little bit about, well, we've talked a lot about how we're restructuring world trade and the world economy around this new world of physical things and physical assets. If we could you both just help our listeners, let's build a bit of a map of what the current state of play is internationally. I know that this is so complicated that you've written a book on it, Ed, and Richard, you've been working on this for many years. So we're going to try and do in a nutshell, what's currently going on? And then where are the bottlenecks and where are the flashpoints? And I'm aware you're not going to be able to touch on everything here, but yeah, what does the current state of play look like, and what's happening, what changes are happening?
I mean, in my field of technology, metals and lithium ion batteries, you know, the big story was that, you know, a couple of decades ago, China decided to not bother competing with the rest of the world in producing combustion vehicles and go flat out to dominate the next generation of technologies which they saw coming, which was the lithium ion battery and its use in electric vehicles. So the Chinese economy and the Chinese Communist Party have been prosecuting a very successful business plan, basically, to build the supply chains they need to massively scale lithium-ion batteries and electric vehicles, which means they own a huge number of the upstream resources. But really, more than upstream resources, where the real bottleneck and where the real challenge is turning the dirt or the brine that you flow out of the ground into the usable chemicals that you need to make the lithium ion battery. And that's where the real chokehold is in terms of Chinese dominance. China also dominates the production of batteries themselves. They, by many multiples, they produce more batteries than anyone else. And it's a scale game. The bigger the scale, the lower the cost. The lower the cost, the cheaper the car. The cheaper the car, the more people buy it. China has just become the largest auto exporter on planet Earth. They now export more cars than Japan and Germany, and that's the direction of travel. So there's been a very, you know, we've been kind of asleep at the wheel in the rest of the world, focusing on our kind of legacy businesses. And now you see automakers in Europe and North America scrambling to catch up. The only exception to that rule, obviously, is Tesla, who dragged our industry forward by 10 years and has been fabulously successful. And I think we all owe Tesla a huge debt of gratitude for kind of their trailblazing. So it really is in the refining of these raw materials where China has a real advantage. These minerals themselves are pretty distributed across the world. You know, there's plenty of lithium in Australia and North America and Latin America and Africa. There's nickel all over the world. There's cobalt cobalt is obviously a DRC dominated mineral, but we're using less and less cobalt in batteries these days. So really, the challenge isn't in where these minerals are. The challenge is turning them into useful chemicals that you can make batteries out of and then making the batteries themselves. And that's what we're focused on at TechMet. We're focused on building resilient, localized, high ESG standard supply chains for the US and its economic allies. The good news is that there's a lot of opportunity and capacity for us to go and build. The challenge is, can we do it quickly enough to make a difference and make sure that we can build those supply chains to shore up Western manufacturing of electric vehicles?
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the other, you know, it's the Chinese lead on batteries is extraordinary at the moment. And you know, the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, and also solar panels. I mean, again, like, it's almost complete dominance. And as Richard's saying, you know, if there's one country that has understood the exigencies of what I call the material world, which is basically just saying you need, you know, it's helpful to think about where stuff comes from and what you do it to get it into products. There's one country that has been thinking strategically about this for a long time. It's China. And they've been thinking in the terms of the decades. And we, the rest of us, are only kind of getting around to it now. And, you know, when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, that is an incredibly bold attempt to try and wrest some of this production back to the US. But it's still, I think, an open question as to whether it's going to work, or indeed whether it's going to persevere. I mean, there's political risk coming up in the next year for the US in a big way. And when you look at Europe, I mean, yeah, like Richard's saying, China, when you see those charts of Chinese car imports into Europe, you know, it's exponential. It's a line going up like that. And so far, in terms of kind of, you know, revealed preferences, Europe is still moving relatively slowly, as far as I can make out, compared with, you know, the way that China has rappled up with the rest of the world. So I just, I question at the moment whether the incentives are there for Europe to be able to kind of turn around and rebuild this industry that, well, it never really had a battery industry. It certainly had a solar industry in the past. And I think the double challenge on top of it is that while the US has on its side the fact that you have these enormous incentives, like I say, question marks over them, but you also have the fact that they have incredibly much more plentiful and comparatively cheaper energy than in Europe. Europe is deindustrializing right now. I think it's kind of terrifying. You look at some of these charts of energy consumption in Europe, and primarily because of industrial energy use, it's gone through the floor. We're not making fertilizer anymore. At least the amount of fertilizer we're producing in Europe has gone down incredibly fast. We don't make fertilizer. So we used to have two big fertilizer plants. And the reason I mention fertilizer is it's just another one of these basic building blocks. And actually being able to make ammonia is quite helpful when you're making other things. So if you're making carbon fiber, you need acrylonitrile, which you make from ammonia. So, you know, this whole complex of different products actually has a bearing on whether we're able to make the stuff that goes into a wind turbine, because you need carbon fiber to go into a wind turbine. We're not making this stuff in Europe anymore. We just shut down in the UK. We've shut down our two fertilizer plants, which had the Haber-Bosch process, taking natural gas and turning it into ammonia, so nitrogen, which you could then use for fertilizer and explosives, by the way. And we just don't make it anymore. We import it all from overseas. We import it from North Africa and we import it from America. And that you see that across Europe. You know, the place that invented the Haber-Bosch process is no longer carrying out the Haber-Bosch process for the manufacture of fertilizer, BASF in Germany. This is kind of extraordinary. And it's obviously a consequence of enormous kind of political chaos that's happening right now with what's happening in Ukraine and what that does to gas prices. But that's the difficulty. To go back to the point, Europe is trying to do this transition while also having really high energy costs, which are crippling its industrial base. And I find that a really difficult, double-edged kind of challenge for it to have. And, you know, we'll probably hopefully get to a point, you know, if we are in this kind of different universe where you have blocks of nations rather than a big globalized world, which is something we all need to be thinking about, because that is the world that we had for the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, was a massive untrammeled system of globalization. If we're in this other world, then we do need to be thinking kind of strategically about who's going to be mining the stuff, where's it going to be made, Are they a friend? Are they a potential foe? And that's a weird world to be in. I've got to tell you, you know, I mean, Richard's more familiar with what's going on in the kind of financial sphere. But as far as I can make out, very few people have been thinking in those kind of geostrategic terms over the last few decades. It's quite unfamiliar, but you need to kind of engage with it, because that's kind of where we are. And your normal textbook about globalization 101, That's not relevant anymore. We're in a whole new. I mean, have you encountered that, Richard? Like, kind of unfamiliarity amongst people on this?
Yeah, I mean, there was. I would describe it as a sort of naivety, which is gradually now kind of the scales are falling from people's eyes about the reality of how these supply chains work, and I would guess it's the vulnerability and the interdependence that we now kind of pervade the West in terms of our dependence on China for so much. I mean, the analogy is the dependency on oil and the Middle East and the oil shocks of the 70s. I mean, we're kind of heading towards, you know, potential you know, kind of critical mineral shock with how reliant we are on China. So, you know, my view is though that there's a lot to play for still, and there's a huge amount of potential in the West. One of the West's kind of trump cards is we do have vast mineral wealth across North America, across Australia, South Africa, and other parts of the world. And we also have fantastic innovation in the West. So there are, you know, I can guarantee that the supply chains we have today won't be the supply chains we have in 10 years, because there is enormous amounts of innovation going on in how we extract these minerals and how we actually are going to end up making batteries. There is technology out there that we've invested in, which is going to end up collapsing parts of the supply chain. We have a company in America called Zeron Advanced Battery, which electroplates cathodes onto foils with impure feedstocks. We do not need 99.99% pure lithium hydroxide and nickel and cobalt sulfates to make batteries. We can make them out of impure feedstocks. So there are technologies out there which are going to be able to circumvent some of the chokeholds that China has on this industry. And so, you know, the West has to focus on what it can do well, which is innovate, rely on its brilliant universities and scientists, rely on its open free capital markets, and rely on the fact that we do have vast geological wealth at our disposal.
Richard, just to ask you a couple of points about TechMet. What strikes me is, so it's US government backed, and it's looking to take strategic control over the production of metals, specifically around energy metals or battery metals, right? And is this a defensive move, or is this, it feels like with the Inflation Reduction Act and these kind of programs, the US at least has a strategy, right? Is executing a strategy, which is to take back control of a lot of the production and refinement and essentially the supply chains we're talking about. And does Europe have that? Or does the UK have that? Where are we on all of those things?
Yeah, I mean, just to talk about TechMet for a second, you know, we're a private investment company that is partially backed by the United States government, but also the majority of our capital actually comes from private investors. But we are very closely aligned with the US, and our strategy is to build resilient, high environmental standard supply chains for the benefit of the US and its economic allies. The US is, you know, the luckiest country in the world. It's blessed with, you know, incredible domestic resources, protected by two oceans, with a great legal system, brilliant people, the deepest capital markets, and a government that can coordinate action on a scale which frankly no one else can. So your question about the kind of relative action of America versus Europe, I mean, Europe is just starting out at a disadvantage relative to America. It's a much harder coordination problem for Europe. It's certainly, you know, I would say in third place behind China and the US. When it comes to the UK, we obviously decided to leave Europe, making that challenge even harder. So there are obviously, the UK is trying to catch up. I mean, we've invested in Cornish Lithium down in Cornwall for the extraction of lithium from both hard rock sources and brine sources. And we want to make sure that lithium stays in the UK for the benefit of UK manufacturing. The UK government has been very helpful to develop that business. We announced a $30 million investment this summer from the UK Infrastructure Bank, which has been enormously helpful and constructive. But it's harder for smaller countries to compete against the giant economic blocks of the US and China. And as Ed said, you know, there are all sorts of challenges that Europe faces with political instability on its kind of eastern borders, high energy costs, etc. The fundamentals aren't the same in Europe as they are in the US. I'm a big bull on the US. I believe the US is, you know, kind of a sleeping giant. When it decides to do something, it normally ends up doing it better than anyone else. Just look at the way it mobilized its industrial base during the Second World War to, you know, become the dominant world power. I think the US is on the cusp of another great industrial revolution. It's reshoring a huge amount of manufacturing. You're seeing the Inflation Reduction Act and other legislation lead to an Cambrian explosion in all parts of the battery supply chain across the US. And so I think that the US is the rate of growth and the potential for the US to catch up is fantastic. And I think we're going to get there.
What's interesting, actually, I should say about the UK. So we, again, I kind of talk quite a lot to kind of politicians and policymakers about this kind of thing increasingly. And I've actually been into government to talk about my book. I don't know whether that's encouraging or whether that's terrifying that they would get a journalist in to talk about these things. But nonetheless, what's kind of interesting here is that, you know, we went from a situation where you had various governments like the Theresa May government, the Boris Johnson government, who were going on about industrial strategy, you know, and we've got a strategy and it's going to be focused. And they produced lots of blueprints and had lots of grand plans about it. But actually kind of it amounted to next to nothing. And now you've got a government where, you know, Rishi Sunak doesn't especially, it's not his natural territory. He's slightly more, I think, at home with things like AI and that kind of soft tech, as it were. But he's, I think he recognises now that this is a big issue. Jeremy Hunt actually has become increasingly focused on this stuff. So you're in this kind of strange place, actually, where the UK has probably more of an industrial strategy than it has done for years and years, is focusing on this. It's putting a lot of money by UK standards into 2 gigafactories, you know, quite a lot of money by UK standards. We're trying to rebuild the entire kind of steel industry. So get rid of those blast furnaces, because we had a very kind of carbon intensive steel industry compared with most countries. And so now we're going to kind of go there. In terms of like the absolute scale, there's no way that the UK can compete. And in terms like of leaving the political bloc that is the EU, that, you know, we're not part of that bloc. So we don't have that power of being part of an enormous market for consumption. I don't know yet whether the UK can be a kind of a bridge between the US and the EU. I don't see any evidence of that being the case at the moment. However, what I would say is, we were talking a moment ago about, you know, how do you kind of manage a world where it is genuinely multipolar, where you do have kind of different blocks, and you should be trying to think about, okay, we need this supply chain for X and Y, whether it's batteries or solar panels or whatever it is. And we kind of need to think about how we can actually work as collaboratively as possible, you know, while also maintaining kind of economic incentives. And it's possible the UK could play a role there. I've also just been up to one of the new clusters. So clusters, we don't talk about clusters much. Have you had an episode on clusters yet? Probably not.
We haven't yet.
Industrial clusters like... No, okay, well, maybe that's one for the future. Industrial clusters or not. Industrial clusters, you know, you've got all these areas, particularly in the UK, where you've got heavy industry kind of clustered in a certain area, just because you have, in the case of the Northwest, there's kind of a lot of salt there. So salt, actually, it is the basis for a lot of our chemicals industry. Where the salt is also where the chemicals factories are. But also the salt then becomes soda ash, which then goes into the glass. So you've got glass factories there. You've got places that are making fertilizer as well. At least they were until they shut them down recently. You've got oil refineries, all of these things together in a small spot. They're all massively carbon intensive. In order to try and crack some of those things, hopefully you can do it with electricity. But actually, there are certain things like a massive glass furnace that you probably are going to need some sort of a flame for. Talk to anyone in the glass industry and they're like, you still need a flame, like it or not. And so you're going to need hydrogen. And it might well be that in the management of these clusters, the UK actually is more advanced than most other places around the world, because we have plans for clusters that go beyond what you see in the US and beyond what you see in much of Europe. So in certain kind of like small forensic areas, it might not necessarily be innovation, but it might be corralling different kind of, you know, different interested parties into something that actually works, you know, and that is the UK might have a lead. And that is actually some of the toughest stuff in the energy transition, you know, actually making carbon capture a going thing, you know, a going concern. No one's worked out how to do that. Actually turning hydrogen into something which is a functional part of a different set of industries. No one's managed to do that yet so far. So there are little areas where the UK could actually have some interesting leadership, but it's the scale thing. You know, we are still very small. We've got lots of smart people here. We're very good at inventing stuff. We're terrible at turning inventions into something that can become a kind of commercial reality. You know, we invented the lithium ion battery and then obviously didn't make anything of it. Although actually the interesting story on the lithium ion batteries, the conventional story is we invented the lithium ion battery, or at least, you know, some of the biggest kind of advances in the cathode chemistry happened in Oxford. And then it was Sony and Japan that managed to turn it into a going concern. We did actually have a factory up in the very, very north of Scotland, which at the time was called AGM, which took those lithium ion technology and turned it into C-size batteries. Some of the world's first big lithium ion batteries were made commercially in the UK. But rather than being made to go into nice little devices that everyone wanted to have, they went into nuclear submarines and they went into army kind of radios, because that was the market that we had. We had a defense market rather than having a commercial electronic market. And again, So you come back to these things, you can be as smart as you possibly can, you can come up with all the best patents for whatever it is. But in the end, the market is so important. And right now, it's the US where a lot of the market is. But frankly, it's where China is. China where the market is, because China, as Richard was saying, has a massive electric car market, which is vast compared with what we see in Europe. And so that's, once you get that kind of wheel rolling, the snowball going, it is very hard to resist it. And you see it at the moment in China, and you don't definitely don't see it here in the UK.
I want to ask a question about supply chains that Ed, you go into in great detail in your book. And Richard, I know based on the investments that you guys make, you fully understand this too. And so for our listeners, I think a lot of, if we just talk about battery metals and battery minerals for a second, a lot of folks could say where cobalt comes from, right? As in it comes from the DRC, or they know where there's lithium mines. And then there's a step between that to getting it into a battery cell manufacturer, which is the processing part. Could you just talk a little bit about that? Because it's a key part of the chain that is often missed out, that is fundamental to strategic capture by the US or Europe or anyone who has a vested interest in industrializing in this way.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't put dirt in a battery. You can't make batteries out of impure materials. At least that's how most people make them. As I was alluding to earlier, the majority of the world's refining capacity across the key battery metals, which are lithium, nickel, cobalt, all sits in China. There is a cobalt refinery in Finland. Canada is building nickel refineries. Tesla is building its own lithium hydroxide refining facility in Corpus Christi, Texas. So the West is trying to build its own capacity, but it's a fraction of what exists today in China. And so if you're producing lithium spodumene in Australia, it's pretty much one home for it, and that's to put it on a ship and send it to China.
And it's massively carbon intensive, isn't it? So there's a lot of coal and stuff, isn't it, they're using to turn it into the chemicals?
Exactly. And so you've got to turn these kind of raw ores and raw kind of the units of lithium, nickel, cobalt that come out of the ground. They need several intensive refining steps to be made into kind of 99.9%+ pure materials. They then have to be made into precursor materials that then get made into cathode materials that then eventually find their way to be glued onto these foils, which then get rolled up and made into batteries. And everything downstream of the mine is pretty much dominated by China in terms of capacity. So we've got a lot of catching up to do in the West. But like, as I was alluding to earlier, there are technologies that we're developing here in the West, which might be able to cut out some of those steps. And the virtue of that is you're cutting out carbon, you're cutting out cost, and you're also opening the funnel of raw materials that are available to you to make batteries, including reprocessing old industrial waste piles like tailings at mine sites, which might have cobalt credits in them that weren't extracted when that ore was first mined, and we can reprocess them and get the cobalt out, get the lithium out, get the nickel out. So there's a lot of innovation happening in the West, but we need to keep our foot on the gas. There's a huge amount of capital that has to go in to make that happen, and projects are slow. You've often got permitting issues, you've got infrastructure issues. It is not just like flicking a switch and turning these things on. These things take years to develop. And we're in a scramble in the West to build up our own capacity and create resilient supply chains that we can rely on.
Can I ask a question, Richard? Do you see, like, because there's a lot of people, talking about how there's going to be a shortage of X or Y. But as you said, like, it's not like there's a shortage of lithium in the ground. Do you see, as someone who's actually there on the kind of front line of this, do you see bottlenecks to come? Or actually, is that just a lot of kind of hype and catastrophism?
No, absolutely see bottlenecks to come. We need something like 3 million tons of lithium by the year 2030. We made about 600 odd thousand tons on a global basis in 2022. So we need many multiples of today's production in lithium. And the number of battery factories that are being built around the world, not just in China, but especially in the US and Europe, the amount of lithium that those factories could absorb if they're running at full capacity runs far ahead of the amount of lithium that's in the pipeline to be produced, let alone refined. So the shoe's going to drop somewhere. And I think that there's a very severe risk that some of these factories will have to shut down or just not operate or operate a fraction of their capacity because they won't be able to source the raw materials at any price. So we're in for a very fraught ride as we try and navigate the energy transition in the West. And I think that we're going to see much higher prices across these core materials. And that price is sending a signal to the market. We've already seen very high lithium prices recently to spur a new production, to crowd in new capital. So that price is sending a signal to the market. And I think we're going to see structurally higher prices across the rest of this decade and into the 2030s across all of these minerals.
The discussion we've had today, I can't help but think it actually feels a bit bleak. Okay, so this mountain of work that we need to do and how unprepared we are and the politics and the geopolitics and the, you know, the deglobalization and this non-unipolar world and all this, you know, the breaking of the world order and all this stuff, it's all very, very scary. And so, and the supply chains on the minerals and the metals, are we doing enough? And if not, what can we do? You know, what are the solutions to this?
I mean, the short answer is I don't think we're doing enough. I think there needed to be kind of 10 versions of TechMet 5 years ago doing what we're doing in order to meet the challenge that the West faces to scale the raw material challenge to electrify the world. But, you know, having a pessimistic attitude and saying it's all too late is kind of just not in our DNA. So we need to mobilize not just government, but we need to mobilize capital markets, and we need to work much more closely with our brilliant scientists and engineers in universities to radically scale every technology available to us. I mean, we just made an announcement, one of our portfolio companies announced end of last week, a major investment from one of the largest lithium producers on earth has committed to using our DLE technology called ILiAD to scale lithium production from brines in Argentina. And this is the first major bet by a major lithium producer to deploy DLE technology, which is really the key to unlocking massively scaling lithium from brine resources across the world with minimal environmental footprint. You know, we're talking no big holes in the ground. We're talking very low energy use, very low reagent use. And it really is the key to having low carbon footprint, higher environmental standard lithium that can be controlled and produced by the West. So you've got low embodied lithium in your electric vehicles. You know, the revolution's here, it's happening. And again, the pessimism comes from linear thinking, whereas progress is exponential. Exxon has just announced that it's targeting 100,000 tons of lithium production from Arkansas over the next few years. I mean, the big boys are here deploying their balance sheets and their know-how. So I think that the pessimism is unfounded. The concern is very well founded. I mean, we have to have a collective focus on this in the West. And like I said, it needs to be a concerted effort across the private sector and the public sector. But don't underestimate human ability and our collective ability to affect change.
So the way that I tackle that, I was talking to someone recently about my book, actually, a book critic. And this person said, well, I was a bit frustrated that at the end you didn't kind of come out on one side or the other as being an optimist or a pessimist about this. And it's kind of true, you know, like I spent most of the book veering between depression and optimism, because I kind of think that's the rational place to be right now. The world is kind of scary, but there's also hopeful as well. And I think if you're just, you know, if you don't acknowledge so the scale of the challenge facing us, then I think you risk delusion. But by the same token, if you don't also acknowledge, as Richard says, our ability to turn this stuff around and our ability to do amazing things, then I think you're equally deluded. And I mean, I feel the same thing also when you look at the, you know, the scary situation with geopolitics. It is scary. There's no escaping it. It's one of the scariest times I think that any of us have lived through, certainly since the Cold War. But by the same token, when you spend a bit of time kind of delving into how stuff is made, you know, these supply chains that we spent a lot of time talking about here, not just to make new products, but to make anything, then you realize that we are more interlinked than ever before. I went to a factory the other day where they press metal. It used to be an old pen nib manufacturer, and it's in Birmingham. So of all places, this is in Birmingham in the UK. And these days they make, because they're really good at making thin metals at very kind of micron precision, they also make certain little inputs, bits of metal inputs that go into other things. And I looked at this machine, it was turning out lots of little tiny pieces of metal And it turns out they were electrodes. They're being shipped off to China. And I said, what are they for? They're going to be part of the wing, the rear view mirror in your car. And it's the bit that basically means that it dims when someone, you know, flashes their headlights behind you. It's the auto dimming thing. This electrode allows that to happen. And I said, how many of these things are you turning out at this factory in Birmingham? They said hundreds of millions. It turns out that more than 50% of all of the rear view mirrors in the world have electrodes from this tiny little factory in Birmingham. And what I thought when I encountered that was, first of all, blimey, it's coming from Birmingham of all places, you know, cars on the other side of the world have a little bit of Birmingham in them. But more to the point, these little nodes in the big global map of globalization, there are thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of these companies all over the place. We are all interlinked. The scale and the degree of globalization and our dependence on each other goes far further than trade statistics, or to some extent, even anecdote can even portray. And, you know, I think the Chinese understand this better than we do. I don't think we in the UK understand it, and then in the US and the Eurozone as well understand it all as much as they do in China. And given we understand that, and given we understand how much of a rupture it would be or will be if we really do pull everything apart, my hope is that helps to keep us together. It, by the same token, would mean that, like I say, it would be even more devastating, I think, than we appreciate if we are going to try and pull the whole thing apart. And I think you only really kind of understand that when you start to kind of look beneath, you know, down from bottom up rather than top down, which is kind of what I've tried to do in this book. Then suddenly everything's far more interesting, knotty, scary, but hopeful as well.
So we do have reason to be optimistic, but rationally optimistic, and also equal parts fearful, I think. And so we're almost at the end of the our hour, and I want to give you the mic for our last question, which is our favorite question, which is, what is your contrarian view? What do you guys believe that not everybody else believes with your unique lens on the market?
Yeah, no, I suppose my contrarian view is going to be that the supply chains of these critical minerals in 10 years will look nothing like the supply chains we've got today, because they've got to change. And that means that we're going to be deploying new extraction technologies and new processing technologies and new manufacturing technologies at scale over the next 10 years, which means that the stories that we'll be telling on these kind of podcasts in the year, you know, 2034 will be very, very different from the ones we tell today. There's an imperative around that too. If we don't innovate and deploy new technologies at scale, we're not going to hit the energy transition. And so we kind of have a moral imperative around this to decarbonize our economies. But also we have a geopolitical one here in the West. You know, we're going to be completely beholden to a geopolitical rival. And I think that with a total sort of unified effort across government and the private sector, we're not going to make it. So we have to innovate, and the supply chains are going to have to evolve radically in order to satisfy those goals.
Okay, so I'm a journalist. So basically everything I kind of say or do is quite contrarian. And like I'm a columnist. So I write columns, and the column kind of, you have to be contrarian, or at least I like to be contrarian. So in a way that the book, you know, the book I've written and the whole thesis of that book, at least at the time that I was writing it, seemed pretty contrarian, because a lot of people did kind of assume that we had kind of dematerialized. And the conventional wisdom within my world of economics is that's kind of, you know, that's the way that we have gone. We are kind of eking ever more out of every little bit of resources that's coming our way, which, you know, is true in certain respects. But my point has always been, no, this physical stuff still really matters. We've spent a long time ignoring it. It's incredibly important. I guess my kind of like my subtitle kind of contrarian view is just that it's all, particularly at moments like this where we've got an enormous challenge in front of us, the focus is often on the new stuff. So there is lots of that, you know, Richard's in the sexy stuff. You know, the lithium, the cobalt, this stuff is really sexy and it's really important. But we do have a tendency to focus, you know, we're monomaniacal, it's particularly in the world of the mainstream media. So there's loads of pieces about how important lithium is and how important cobalt is. And there's whatever the kind of sexy material of the day, you're not going to find a shortage of those pieces. But I guess my slightly contrarian point is, we need everything. You know, we're going to need more of everything. We're going to need more steel. We're going to need more concrete. We're going to need more salt, because the salt is the stuff that actually enables us to perform a lot of these transitions, these chemical transitions that help us turn things into a desired product. We're going to need more copper. And copper, I know, is semi-sexy, but it always comes lower down the line than things like lithium and cobalt. And so reminding ourselves that the important, seemingly boring stuff hasn't gone away, and that you need sand and you need aggregates and you need physical things to make stuff. I think we still could do with being reminded of that a little bit. So I just think another kind of slightly contrarian point is, but along the same vein, we often focus on the big new innovation. So someone's just invented X or Y and it's like, wow, that's amazing. You know, you've got solid state batteries or whatever it might be. Or sodium ion batteries. If I could give you a pound for every time I've been doing these talks recently about materials and someone said, ah, yes, well, what about sodium ion batteries? And that, there is potentially going to be a place for sodium ion batteries. Don't get me wrong. I'm no great expert on the sodium ion battery market. And, you know, Richard might have some other thoughts on that.
We need all the energy storage we can get.
Well, right. Okay. And that's kind of the point is, there's this focus on the new, but actually we need all of it. And we're going to need a load of lithium ion batteries, a crazy amount of lithium ion batteries like you were laying out. We're going to need an enormous amount of wind turbines. We're going to need an enormous amount of all of this stuff. While people focus on this new exciting invention, whatever it might be, for me, what's more exciting is the iterative, gradual processes whereby we get better and better every year at making staple things like batteries. Batteries get cheaper. They get more effective. They get slightly more energy dense. Wind turbines get bigger. They get able to produce more power. You know, same thing with solar panels. That's the kind of learning curve whereby every year we get that little bit better. And it's not just it's not just the sexy stuff. Motors get better every year, and they get more efficient at turning that power into motion. And why? It's because we're better at making the plastics that go in there as separators. It's all these little tiny things that add up over time to an extraordinary improvement in, you know, human progress and our living standards. And we forget about that boring stuff because it's not headline news. It's not the front page of the FT. But that is happening all the time. Engineers are making things better. They're making things that weeny bit better. And it just builds up. And so I think that's the sexy, exciting stuff that we don't focus on enough, because it's not new. And it's not a big kind of Einsteinian eureka moment.
And it's a real blind spot of kind of human psychology that we tend to think in linear fashion, but actually things develop and compound, and the sort of microscopic advances and the way that we get better and better at doing more and more with less and less in this world, that effect compounds over time. And we tend to overestimate the impact of technology in the short run and radically underestimate the impact of technology in the long run. And so I think that there's so many criticisms today about electric vehicles, you know, oh, well, you know, you're charging them with electricity that's made with coal, and, you know, they've only got a range of 200 miles. We're in the first innings of this revolution. You know, if you went back and looked at the first mass market car, the Model T Ford in the 1920s, and compare it today to a modern BMW. I mean, it's like the BMW looks like it's an alien spacecraft. Well, that's because there's been 100 years of incredible innovation around it. And the same goes with electric vehicles. The electric vehicles that we're going to be driving in the 2030s will look nothing like the electric vehicles we're driving today. The range, the performance, and also the supply chain behind it, the carbon footprint behind it, where it's made, how it's made, it's going to look nothing like it is today. And so people tend to underestimate the compounding effect of engineering and human progress. And so I violently agree with Ed.
Can I say one other thing we underestimate, okay, which is that there's always a conventional wisdom that something is just going to be too difficult. So you like the thing these days is nuclear fusion. It's just going to be too difficult. And some people say similar things about solid state batteries and stuff. One of the things I learned, you know, by going back and looking at all these materials and what we've done with them over time, is there's always someone saying it's impossible. You know, there was someone who was saying there were people who were saying it was impossible to have a solid state transistor, you know, semiconductors. The people who said that was impossible. There were people who were saying it was impossible to generate EUV light and use it to do lithography. That's how we make transistors these days. People said it was impossible. There were people who would say we would never rediscover the recipe for concrete, you know, which we lost for more than 1,000 years, for heaven's sake. People always, a lot of the time, when something is tough and when it takes a long time to kind of come up with it, there's the conventional wisdom can accrete and just you know, say, well, we're never going to come up with it. But invariably we do. It just takes a while sometimes to come up with it. So I imagine, like Richard says, in a few, you know, in years to come, we will look back at this time and say, how did we ever doubt that this or that was possible? And so that's why it's exciting right now to be going through this time. It's scary in certain ways, but it's also exciting because the scale of what we have set ourselves as a challenge is massive. And I think we are capable of doing it.
So Ed, Richard, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us on the podcast. A bit of an unusual one for us. And we talked a lot about metal stuff and battery stuff, which is great because that's what our listeners really care about in the energy transition. But a bigger picture as well. Thank you for coming and joining us and sharing your thoughts. Ed, good luck with, well, the book's absolutely fantastic. And it just seems like critic review, the list on Amazon just seems to get longer and longer and longer, which is great. And Richard, and all good stuff too. And Richard, good luck to you and the team in getting strategic control over the metals that really matter to us.